First off, this hour, in the wake of the murder in Charlottesville over the weekend, after neo-Nazi and white supremacist rallies and counter-protests, I want to have a conversation about that line between free speech and hate speech, what's protected, what's not, where does being safe fall into all of this, and who gets to draw the line? Some thoughts now from Jane Kirtley, who is the University of Minnesota's Scylla Professor of Media Ethics and Law, also director of the Scylla Center, an expert on the First Amendment. Jane, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Good morning.
Your questions about where must speech be protected and not protected, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You can tweet me at WeberTom1. And please don't call or text or tweet if you're driving. According to current law, Jane, established through statutes and court ruling, what elements of this weekend's events in Charlottesville were protected speech and which were not?
I would say almost all of the speech was protected speech. In this country, based on Supreme Court precedent, we have very, very broad protection for virtually any kind of speech as long as it doesn't constitute a true threat, and there's a specific view of what that means, and as long as it's not an incitement to violence that is imminent and likely to occur. So to kind of back off a minute, if we're talking about speech online, the Supreme Court so far has been very reluctant to suggest that any kind of speech online, whether it's social media or on a website, could actually sink or rise to the level of incitement. In the context of the riots in Charlottesville, there might have been some specific instances where something that was being stated provoked someone to lash out and hit someone over the head or something like that, that would probably fall under the category of fighting words. But for the most part, expressions, however hateful, are going to be protected under the First Amendment. And in fact, the Supreme Court has never said anything along the lines of hate speech is not constitutionally protected. And in fact, they've never defined the phrase hate speech.
Okay, so people have been using the phrase hate speech. If you speak out, if you're a white supremacist, if you're talking about killing Jews or killing black people, whether that actually even constitute hate speech, what, doesn't really have an answer. Is that right, Jane?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think everybody seems to think it has a legal definition, and in many other countries it does. But in fact, again, going to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is the highest authority on this, they have never really defined the term. And I can give you a specific example. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, the city of St. Paul passed an ordinance to try to basically make it a crime if you were expressing statements that aroused anger, alarm, or resentment in others on the basis of race, color, creed, religion, or gender. The Supreme Court struck that down, basically saying that you were punishing speech that should be protected unless it constituted a true threat. So the problem is that a lot of things that people think they shouldn't be allowed to say because it's going to upset people or it's going to make them angry or frightened or something like that, unless it falls into these narrow categories of being a true threat directed at an individual or a group that's, you know, present right there, or unless it's an incitement to violence, the reality is it's going to be protected under the Constitution.
So what constitutes a threat? What constitutes an incitement?
Well, incitement is easy to explain. That's a situation where you have the intent to create illegal activity, that it is imminent, that is, it's going to happen, you know, within seconds or moments right before your eyes, and that it's likely to occur. Because obviously, if you make a statement that might incite violence in a context of, I don't know, a meeting of a Quaker meeting or something like that, the likelihood is that particular audience is not going to respond with violence. If you're speaking to a group of individuals that are armed and ready to go in riot gear, that would be a different situation. But as I said, the Supreme Court has really not accepted the notion that online or digital content could constitute that kind of incitement to imminent lawless action. Whether that will change as we're becoming more and more used to having, you know, handheld devices and the immediacy is clear, I don't know. But to date, and their most recent decisions from just a few years ago were simply posting things on websites and so forth, the court has said no, that doesn't constitute incitement because it's not imminent, that being the important part. Fighting words are words that would invoke an immediate violent reaction from someone, the kind of thing that if someone says it to you, you're likely to punch them out. Beyond that, you know, it becomes sort of a laundry list of terms that the court has found to constitute fighting words. It's obviously a fairly broad category, but by the same token, pretty specific in terms of again, the intent and who your audience is.
So Jane Kirtley with us from the University of Minnesota. We're talking about some free speech, First Amendment ramifications, and what is and isn't the law right now. If you have a question about this in the wake of these events in Charlottesville over the weekend, one woman was killed there on the ground. 1-800-242-2828. Does any of this end? Do any of these protections end, Jane, the moment the first punch is thrown or the moment the car drives down the mall and starts hitting people?
Well, I think here's the thing. Driving the car down the mall and hitting people is not expression. You know, I mean, there, I've heard First Amendment absolutists say, you know, that is, and they try to equate it to things like burning a flag. They say, you know, burning a flag, if that's expression, then driving a car into a crowd would also be expression. Well, it's not. And part of the reason for that is a very simple kind of legalistic conceit, which is to say driving a car in the middle of a crowd, regardless of your motivation, is against the law. And that's one of the things that the Supreme Court focused on in the RAV versus St. Paul case, saying there are many ways St. Paul could have punished the activity that was involved there, which involved burning a cross on somebody's lawn, trespass, violation of fire ordinances, all kinds of things. They said they don't need to get into the business of policing the expression because the act itself is criminal.
What about the tiki torches? Friday night's rally before the day before the woman was killed there on Saturday. On Friday night, walking with tiki torches through the University of Virginia campus, is that incitement?
I would not call it incitement under the law because, quite honestly, I think that although the carrying the torches certainly has symbolic resonance, you know, going all the way back, obviously, to the Third Reich and Germany and Nazis carrying doing torchlight parades, I think that the argument would be that there are probably legal ways to use tiki torches in a demonstration. And just like the burning crosses, the question would be, one of the questions would be, what is the intent? And it's often very difficult to determine intent in a context where mm-hmm. you might have multiple meanings being conveyed. Well, I can certainly understand why the tiki torch people want to kind of disavow this because of its strong symbolism, but I think it is protected speech, unless, of course, they're violating a fire ordinance or something like that, and that's how you get them.
You're talking about the actual company that makes tiki torches. They actually did release a statement. Incidentally, the tiki torch and the tiki concept is a Polynesian cultural moment. So for a group of white supremacists calling for America First and white power, it's an interesting use of what is a Polynesian cultural effect. But the Nazi flag. I'm seeing memes on the internet saying, look, the Nazi flag calls for ethnic cleansing. Therefore, its incitement, it is a call to action to kill Jews and black people. And because it's this symbol, it shouldn't be protected just to fly the Nazi flag. Is that true?
Well, in some countries, the display of the Nazi flag is prohibited. Germany, it's illegal to do that. We don't have a law like that. And, you know, I would argue, again, looking at the RAV versus St. Paul, the question would be, you have to probe into what the intent is in displaying the flag. I mean, it's the same argument that's come up in the context of the Confederate flag. People that say it's a sign of white supremacists, others say it's a sign of historical heritage. You know, it has multiple meanings, and absent a clear intent, I think the court is very reluctant to go down that road. So, I mean, I'm not saying somebody couldn't pass a law, but I think it would be of doubtless constitutionality.
So the question I then lead into, Jane, with that primer, and I appreciate the primer, and I appreciate where you're talking about what is protected and what is not. It's interesting that this is a moment when communities of color are speaking out as much as well, because people of color didn't write the First Amendment, and they haven't written the Supreme Court rulings you note that help draw these lines. Is that important to remember? How does that play into the conversation about where communities of color have even been allowed to be part of this conversation?
I understand this argument, and actually we hear it a lot here at the University of Minnesota campus from students from a variety of ethnic and cultural and racial backgrounds, is saying, you know, we didn't have a place at the table. Why should we be bound by this? I guess I would respectfully say that it was the First Amendment that protected speech, which, for example, in the South, was considered to be traitorous when people were trying to go forward with the civil rights movement. It was the First Amendment protected their rights to do that. So in many respects, the protections they enjoy today are part of that legacy. You know, were the people that drafted the First Amendment and our Constitution, were they perfect? No. They were living 200 years ago in a very different world. But I think the principle that they espouse, this idea that the government doesn't get to decide what are acceptable viewpoints, is critical and for everyone, because, you know, if nothing else, the current administration should be a warning to people that if the government's going to step in and decide, for example, what's fake news, that's really going to limit our ability to communicate and to receive information.
Jane Curley with me from the University of Minnesota, taking your questions as well, for example, from Brian, who is in Portland, Maine. Hi, Brian. What's your question here today?
Well, thank you, Tom, and to you and your listeners for this discussion. Where my question ultimately lies is in a responsibility, because for a quick analogy, the people in Charlotte, the mayor and police chief and so on, they had a quandary with that rally taking place because of the amount of guns and weapons. So the ACLU did support and defend this to happen. But really, it's one thing to yell fire in a crowded theater, but this was really the equivalent of yelling fire while you're holding a blowtorch. Mm-hmm. So it just creates a situation that is that much more imminent.
Brian.
So it's
yeah. No, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. Go ahead and finish your thought.
Well, and so it really puts these mayors and police chiefs in a situation where it may be a rally, but as you say, with incitement that you cannot prove. So you're in this situation where they cannot prove this will happen because they're looking at the future. But they know that the crowd that will show up to make their insightful statements are heavily armed.
Yeah.
And they're going down that direction. So where do you mince that situation?
Great question.
That's my question.
No, I appreciate the question, Jane. And he mentioned fire in a theater, which is one of the tests. If you yell fire in a theater, that incites panic. That is a tested ruling in the courts. You can't yell. That is not protected speech. You can't yell fire in a theater.
You can't falsely yell fire in a crowded theater.
That's true.
People often drop that very important modifying word. But
that's
be
true.
That as it may, I mean, I certainly take the point. And yes, there are actions that are clearly intended to and are likely to incite panic or other unlawful conduct. I absolutely agree. But the caller is also correct that it is very difficult for government officials to sort of thread the needle in these kinds of situations, because if they allow demonstrations, if they allow parades, if they allow marches down through the main street or in a city park or something like that, they can only impose reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. They can't bar somebody because they don't agree with their point of view, whether it's the right or the left. It doesn't matter. It protects all sides. The government has to be viewpoint neutral in these contexts. I mean, a lot of the commentary I've seen has been kind of excoriating the Charlottesville police and saying that they dropped the ball and they should have planned it better on so on and so forth. And I noticed that Texas A&M University has canceled a gathering that they were going to have in September because they say we just can't keep people safe. And the question of whether that is a reasonable basis on which to ban or control demonstrations is something that, you know, we're going to have to kind of see how it plays out. And so often in this country, it's because it's common law, that is, it's judge-made law, it's very, very specific to the particular circumstances. But I think Charlottesville just had a tough situation to deal with because they're a bastion of free speech. They have been ever since Thomas Jefferson founded the university, and I'm sure it's very difficult for them to think that they would shut down anybody.
The ACLU, as the caller noted, came in for criticism from some groups. Over the weekend, they tweeted, "The First Amendment is a critical part of our democracy, and it protects vile, hateful, and ignorant speech. For this reason, the ACLU of Virginia defended the white supremacist right to march." But then later, I think it was the next day, they tweeted, "We know our defense of free speech yesterday isn't enough for some, and we understand. We hope you will still find places to work with us. How do you thread that needle? How do you thread the needle, especially on that earlier point we had about communities of color? We're hearing about, you know, you and I, Jane, as white people, don't walk past statues and feel it and don't feel the weight of history like a black person might walking past a Confederate soldier or a Native American past a statue of Christopher Columbus. And there's one, by the way, right by the Minnesota Capitol. So how do we account for that going forward in, by the way, an ever increasingly diverse country?
Well, I think it's reasonable to ask the kinds of questions that are being asked in the South and elsewhere about whether statues that were not erected immediately after the Civil War, but over 100 years later in the context of the Civil Rights Movement, really represent what we, the people, believe. If we're talking about what's on public property, I mean, obviously somebody can display whatever they want on, you know, their own front yard or at a private company or something like that. And many people are suggesting that the thing to do with these things is not to obliterate them, but to move them into museums and other places where they can be looked at in context. It strikes me that that is a reasonable compromise in trying to address all of these concerns. I realize, like all compromises, it won't please everyone and everybody will come away from feeling wounded, but that seems to me to be one way to address that problem.
Let's take a call here from Josh, who's in Stillwater. Hi, Josh. What are your thoughts here today? Thanks for calling.
Yeah, first time, and there's a reason I don't call in, because it's not a public speaker at all, but the question I have is, I attended a Support the President at our Capitol last year at the St. Paul downtown, and the counter-protests are what I see as inciting the behavior, the confrontation. Pepper spray was sprayed in the Capitol. Arrests were made, but all charges were dropped, and there's no accountability. So if we continue to allow that type of behavior and getting away with it, for lack of better words, without just having a peaceful conversation or a gathering on either points of view, I really feel that it's going to continue. And it was so nerve-wracking. And I actually, to be able to leave the Capitol, left my sign in there because of the confrontation. So at some point, we need to realize that it's both sides. And inciting the violence is having two extreme opposite points of view, yelling it back and forth, and the anxiety of being protecting oneself or protecting that free speech. At what point do we say, okay, let's have this group have their conversation, let's get it out in the conversation started, because these there's a group of people having this point of view, and not have both teams or different points of view and no accountability ever. So it's going to continue. At what point, and you'll have to frame it up for me a little better,
sure,
struggling with it a little bit, but that's where there's so many people that are having to feel protecting themselves because, but yet still want their voice heard, but can't really do it. And that's my one and only that I've ever attended, just because it's too nerve-wracking.
And Josh, just to clarify, you support Trump. You were there to support the president. Is that right?
Yes, and just trying to show there are other points of view. Mm-hmm. It was my first rally in 44 years, and wanted to show that there's another point, and there is a reason we voted for president. Even he's a little odd, but he has a lot of alignment with many of us that voted, and there were so many against Trump. So there was a gathering there just to say, hey, we're the people that supported Trump and his points of view and his values, and for 80% of them, you know, more than are the other candidate, obviously. But I was just wanted to try to show our communities that there are other points of view out there too, and it's not always. There was a bunch of pre that as against Trump, and so that just wanted to get out there and show the support of our president, commander in chief.
Josh, thanks so much for the call. Jane, I mean, you hear what Josh is talking about as a Trump supporter. Certainly the president in his initial statement talked about both sides, for which he received a lot of criticism. And we've dissected that criticism for sure on this show. But to Josh's point, you know, obviously there are going to be people tweeting me who disagree with what Josh said, who say that the president's response, et cetera, et cetera. But if Josh truly feels that and didn't feel safe, felt in his heart that the incitement was there, where do we go from there? Where does that kind of a conversation happen on the free speech front?
I am certainly not going to dispute what Josh's feelings are. They're his feelings. He's entitled to have them. I think I would disagree with this idea that there's disparate treatment, that if you're pro-Trump, you're not protected. If you're anti-Trump, you are. I'm not saying that never would happen. It ought not to happen because, again, governmental law authorities should be content and viewpoint neutral, and they should protect everyone who is peacefully expressing a viewpoint. I mean, that's the should. That's the ideal.
There were arrests at the Capitol.
Yes.
At that event, although yes. Josh notes that the charges were dropped. I'd have to confirm that, but we'd have to get into that a little bit. I want to play a piece of audio. This is actually from this morning, the Daily Progress, which is the newspaper in Charlottesville, doing fantastic work, by the way. I encourage people to follow them on Twitter and read their website. Michael Bragg, a reporter for them, tweeted a series of videos, a man in a Confederate uniform holding a Confederate flag and with a semi-automatic rifle over his shoulder stood in front of the Robert Lee statue in question, which drew a crowd of about 12 or 15 people and, of course, the cameras. The crowd around the man, this man was standing there alone. That crowd started chanting at him. He said nothing. One woman was holding her middle finger up about an inch from his face as the group shouted, "Terrorists go home.
Terrorists go home! Terrorists go home! Terrorists go home!"
We later learned from this Twitter feed that man was escorted out of the park by police and driven away. Completely free speech, is that right, Jane? Middle finger right in your nose, that's all okay, is that right?
Well, again, if it rose to the level of fighting words or fighting gestures, it might well have been illegal. I think, you said that the law enforcement escorted him away, and my guess is that they did that to diffuse the situation, although I'm sure some will frame it as silencing him and silencing his silent protest.
Mm-hmm.
It is very difficult. And again, I think it comes back to the point that the Supreme Court made in the St. Paul case, which is that the same words and the same phrases can be used by two different sides for two totally different purposes. And the problem is if you prohibit the word or you prohibit the sign, you're basically prohibiting there being the kind of discussion that the earlier caller was talking about. I mean, he was talking about having a conversation. And in the ideal world, of course, that's what we want to have happen.
Final thought here. It's a final minute. Sorry to concise consent to
I'll
make
be
it
quick.
So big a way. But you have this concept of protecting free speech versus if that's protected, then are you protecting white supremacy? Again, that goes back to the conversation being had. Is that a false choice? I mean, where do you go with that? I mean, there is a lot of concern that if you protect this speech, you are also protecting white supremacy.
I think there's a difference between protecting the right to express the view and supporting or condoning the view. That, to me, is the distinction. We protect the principle, just as in Skokie, Illinois, large Jewish population, the Nazis were allowed to march. Horrible situation for those there, but central to the concept that government does not distinguish between different kinds of viewpoints, and we encourage even the speech we hate. That's what the First Amendment exists for. If all it protected was the speech we all agreed with, it wouldn't really do us very much good as we try to grapple with these difficult problems.
Final thought. What is still unanswered? What kind of question with free speech about what's protected is still largely unanswered?
From my point of view, the question is really going to come about digital, online, social media speech that is now readily accessible at situations like happened in Charlottesville, and whether a court will determine that that is sufficiently immediate and present to constitute incitement.
Jane Kirtley, University of Minnesota's Scylla Professor of Media Ethics and Law, also Director of the Scylla Center. Thanks so much for your thoughts here today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.